So no diagnostic quandaries here, at least. So I'm just an outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to go through, if you like, the basics of malaria, sort of malaria 101, and then talk about some developments in treatment, and I'm going to pepper the talk with cases. So we start off with a case, and this was a case actually from the same district hospital that we had the case of coccidioides, which I think just illustrates how much travel-related illness we see throughout London, because it's such a multicultural city. And this was a lady who had been in Cameroon up until a fortnight before she presented. She had been doing some volunteer work working in forestry research, so in the rainforests of Cameroon, and she'd been feeling unwell for 4 or 5 days after she'd got back. She had fevers, she had sweats, and she'd been vomiting. Again, geography is important in tropical and travel medicine. Cameroon is here at the crook between West and Central Africa. She'd deteriorated before actually attending hospital, and when she arrived, she was very febrile. She had a reduced conscious level with a GCS of only 10, and again was tachycardic and tachypneic, but not shocked, rather more unwell than the last cases. She had no meningism or rash and no focal signs. She was jaundiced, and she was passing very dark urine. She was anemic and thrombocytopenic, but her clotting, her prothrombin time, was normal. She had a low sodium, and she had some signs of acute kidney injury. She was quite a small, slim lady, so a creatinine of 91 and a urea of 6 were probably abnormal for her. And her blood gas showed some compensated acidosis. I can't recall her lactate, but I think it was raised. So I'm not going to go through this. I mean, clearly malaria is the chief differential diagnosis. Sound effects I didn't expect. But there are some other things that should come in, notably viral hemorrhagic fever from Cameroon, which I have to say was not even thought about in the casualty department when this lady came in. African trypanosomiasis, probably unlikely, given that this would have been West African trypanosomiasis, and it's a more subacute disease. And I put cerebral venous thrombosis up there more because I think it's something that we do sometimes forget about in patients who've been in the tropics, in hot, humid environments, often where they're not used to that. Then they had a fever, may have been vomiting and become dehydrated, and these are all risk factors along with infection for venous sinus thrombosis. So it is something to think about. We've seen at least one case that I can recall at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases, a patient who was evacuated from West Africa with a persistent headache, which was being attributed to refractory malaria, who ended up having a venous sinus thrombosis as the cause of their headache. So it is something that we need to keep in mind. And obviously bacterial sepsis, meningoencephalitis in the differential. Clearly this is a malaria talk, so she had malaria. And she had a parasitemia of 1% reported with Schizont's. And here you can see a thick film. I don't think this is hers, but you can see ring forms of malaria. You can still make out the ring forms despite the absence of red cells because this is a thick film. So she was admitted to the high dependency unit. She had fluid rehydration, and she was started on intravenous quinine. And this was at a time before artesunate was widely available in the UK, and quinine was certainly the standard of care. And she was given a loading dose. She was also given some IV ceftriaxone as a single dose in the emergency department before the diagnosis of malaria was back. This sort of prompts me to ask, what treatment do you use here for malaria? You have artesunate. And has that been for a very long time?
Quite some time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Over the next 12 to 14 hours, she was in a similar clinical state, but her paracetamol rose to 15% the next day. She remained hemodynamically stable, her urea and creatinine rose, but she maintained a good urine output. And she required some blood transfusions because her hemoglobin dropped. By 48 hours, her paracetamol had come down to 0.4%. There'd been no change in her treatment during this time. Her acidosis had improved. Her Glasgow coma score had also improved. There was a brief worry about her ECG. She'd been getting daily ECGs, but her QTC responded to intravenous magnesium, as is often the way. By 72 hours, she was doing better. She started doxycycline on day 3 or 4, and she'd cleared her parasites by 4 days and was discharged a few days after. So this is a really sort of quite, if you like, standard case of severe falciparum malaria. I think it describes that you can still get severe disease with a low paracetamol, particularly if there are schizonts on the blood film, and we'll come on to schizonts again in a minute. The parasite count rise despite adequate therapy within the first 24 hours, again, is something that we're not really surprised about, because those schizonts go on and rupture and will put up the paracetamol. And they also represent an indication that there is a large biomass of malaria that is not visible to the blood film because it's been sequestered and stuck down in the periphery. And I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. And the reduced Glasgow coma score and acute kidney injury early is again what we usually see. And this is some data from Michael Marks, who's one of our star registrars at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases. And this was a study looking at over 100 cases, I think, of severe malaria in the Hospital for Tropical Diseases requiring ICU and the number of complications that they had. And you can see that most have more than one. In terms of the timing, this just shows how typical our case was. Acute kidney injury and impaired Glasgow coma score are things that happen early, but ARDS, which is the other worrying complication, tends to happen 3 or 4 days into therapy. So a bit of an overview about malaria. 5 species, they're listed here. Broad spread throughout the tropics and subtropics, and transmission, of course, by the female Anopheles mosquito. This is the CDC life cycle, which is rather complicated, but it's only useful for pointing out that there is a mosquito stage, and this takes 9 to 12 days, depending on the species and the climate, and it's the reason that you cannot transmit malaria from one patient to the patient next door in a hospital bed. The human stages are better illustrated in this rather neat diagram by Tom Doherty, one of the lecturers on the Diploma in Tropical Medicine, which really simplifies things down quite nicely. So the mosquito injects 10 to 20 sporozoites into the human. These go to the liver, where they go through a stage of asexual reproduction, or schizogeny, in the liver, and then something like 40,000 merozoites come out of the liver. These you don't see in the blood because they rapidly enter the red cells to become trophozoites, which then grow up in this cycle on the right side here into schizonts, which rupture and release merozoites going into trophozoites, and the cycle continues. Every now and then, a trophozoite develops into a gametocyte, which doesn't cause disease in humans, but gets taken up by the mosquito to lead to the mosquito stages that you saw in the earlier slide. Hypnozoites are in brackets because I'm going to talk about them later. The important thing is these schizonts, here's a film showing the schizonts, are very sticky. And the schizonts get stuck in the peripheral circulation where they lead to pathology, but it also means that they're not visible in a peripheral blood smear. So if you see schizonts in the peripheral blood smear, that implies that a lot of the sites where they would normally be attached are saturated with other schizonts, and so there's a lot of malaria that you're not seeing. The other thing is that when this ruptures, you'll see that there are many, many, many little black dots. I hope that projects okay. And each one of these is a merozoite in the offing. So when this ruptures, it will give rise to maybe 16 or 32 merozoites, and therefore the parasitemia is shortly going to rise. So that's why it's a worry if you see, as in this case, schizonts in the peripheral blood. So we're going to talk about all of the species, but concentrating on falciparum malaria, and it's the most important of the malaria species because it causes the most deaths and a significant mortality in returning travellers. Probably in the UK we see about 1% mortality in all falciparum malaria. Prophylaxis is highly effective against Plasmodium falciparum, so it's all entirely avoidable. And the pathogenesis, which I'm not going to dwell on too much, is multifactorial, but compared to the other species, falciparum does infect red cells of all ages, which can lead to a higher parasitemia. There are these two sort of related behaviors, rosetting and sequestration. Rosetting is when infected and uninfected red cells clump together, forming a large clump that has difficulty getting through the capillaries. Sequestration is when the cells stick down to the endothelium, again causing reduction in flow in the microvasculature and causing cytokine results as a result of that interaction, all of which contribute to pathology. Both infected and uninfected cells are less squishy. Altered rheology is the posh way of saying that, and that means that they can't squeeze through the capillaries as well as they might. So the symptoms. Really, it should be fever and. Pretty much any symptom can be associated with malaria. So if they have a fever or a history of fever, and they've been in a malarial area, they are someone who should be tested and they're at risk. In fact, I'd go a bit further. You need to be quite fuzzy with your maps when you're thinking about malaria in a return traveller. So if you know that malaria is in one part of the country but not in the other part of the country, and they've only been to the part where there isn't malaria, still test them for malaria. It's a very cheap test, so don't try and be too clever about the geography when it comes to testing return travellers for malaria. There are a couple of things that are unusual in malaria. Coryza, so runny nose, is said to be unusual in malaria, and rash, unusual to attribute to malaria. But again, it's a cheap test, so worth doing. The tests, blood films remain the mainstay of investigation in most parts of the world, and thick and thin films. The thick film is red cells stacked on top of each other, and then the red cell membranes lysed so that you can see all the way through a large stack of red cells. That clearly improves your sensitivity because you're looking at multiple layers. Unfortunately, with the red cells lysed, it's very difficult to see changes to the red cells that are related to the different species of malaria. So the film is useful for speciation. The thin film is useful for speciation, the thick film for making a diagnosis. Rapid diagnostic tests have really taken off in malaria because of access to microscopy in not just rural parts of Africa, but also in many parts of countries that don't see a lot of malaria. If you're in a peripheral hospital, your microscopists may not see very much, and so their expertise declines, and rapid tests are a useful way of filling that gap. This is a HRP2, histidine-rich protein 2 rapid test. There are others available, and they are now really very sensitive. They're as good as a good microscopist. Classification of severe disease. WHO produces reports on a fairly regular basis, which details the classifications. And there are slight variations from year to year, and slight variations in what we in the UK define compared to WHO. But basically, it's neurological dysfunction, severe anemia, acidosis, renal failure, hypoglycemia, ARDS or even pulmonary edema. Bleeding or DIC is fairly uncommon, but it's a sign of severe disease when it's there. Blackwater fever is now vanishingly rare. Shock is said to indicate possible bacterial co-infection. Now, bacterial co-infection is very common in African children with malaria or with recent malaria, but certainly in adults in non-endemic settings, it's quite rare. Michael Marks did a look at 1,000 patients with ICU malaria published in the literature. The overall incidence of bacteremia was 3% in that group. Maybe slightly underrepresented because a lot of the patients may have had blood cultures done after antibiotics, but still quite low compared to children in Africa. 10% is the cutoff for severe malaria according to the WHO criteria, but certainly in the UK we use 2% as the cutoff for giving parenteral treatment, and peripheral Cheysance would be another indication if the parasitemia is lower than 2%. I've put pregnancy in the elderly, pregnancy because pregnant women are more prone to getting severe disease and complications, and most guidelines suggest that they should be treated with parenteral therapy and admitted. And the elderly, we are increasingly becoming aware that the elderly are more prone to severe disease. So again, special precautions taken in the elderly. And of course, the elderly are traveling more now as well, so we may see more of them. Treatment of severe disease, artesunate, as you all know, has been shown to be better than quinine with a mortality benefit, both in studies in Africa and studies in Asia. However, quinine remains the mainstay of treatment in Africa, and in many other parts of the world is more widely available than artesunate is. And all cases should have a second agent. So artemisinin combination therapies, ACTs, doxycycline or clindamycin. And really that's something that should happen for everyone. Lastly, and this probably isn't a problem for you if you're using artesunate as your main therapy, but certainly in the UK, it's not available everywhere, whereas quinine usually is, and we often are giving telephone advice to doctors, and we have to make it very clear to them that they shouldn't be waiting for artesunate. They should just give what they have, which is quinine, and then we'll get some artesunate to them so that we don't have a treatment delay. Other general management, it's one of these areas where speaking with a specialist centre, if you don't have a lot of experience yourself, is a very good idea. Avoid overfilling. So in severe cases of malaria, they should be what the intensivists call run dry. We used to say fill them to a CVP of between 5 and 10, and then everyone realized that other than acting as a little flag in the neck showing that somebody's severely ill, CVP lines are pretty useless. So now we just say run them a little bit dry. Monitor the blood glucose. 2 hourly whilst they're getting an infusion of quinine, if that's the therapy you're using, otherwise 4 hourly, because hypoglycemia is a complication. And if there is shock or other signs of bacterial infection, then give them some antibiotics. And nurse them in an appropriate place. Common pitfalls. We get a lot of patients who've been living in West Africa in their childhood and think that they are immune. So they present late because they don't think they can get malaria. People who think that they've had the flu or gastroenteritis, or doctors who think that people have hepatitis or meningitis and so don't do the film and don't make the diagnosis. Sometimes patients come in for another indication and then have a fever that doesn't respond. I've seen a patient who was being treated by the orthopedic surgeons for a paronychia with flucloxacillin, moving on to vancomycin, despite a fully sensitive staff being isolated because their fever didn't settle for 5 days. When he went and spoke to him, he'd recently returned from the tropics and had malaria. And then what I've mentioned before, waiting for the drug or waiting for a monitored bed. And the elderly, people to be aware of. In non-severe disease in the UK, these are our options, artemether lumefantrine, dihydroartemisinin piperaquine, malarone, atovaquone proguanil is still sometimes used, and some people still use quinine with doxycycline or clindamycin to follow on. Another case, this is a 47-year-old Caucasian businessman. Apologies to any of you who've done the DTMNH recently, because this is one of Tom's cases. He'd spent 6 weeks in Mozambique with no prophylaxis, and 10 days after return, he became unwell with a fever and splenomegaly, which is quite common in malaria. And his blood film showed falciparum, a low parasitemia, but with pre-Cheysance, which, like Cheysance, make you worried. So he was treated with intravenous quinine. 48 hours later, he deteriorated, became tachycardic, hypotensive and had really quite marked abdominal pain, such that he was seen by a surgeon and referred for a scan. Anyone want to tell me what this scan shows? Any budding radiologists? So this here is all abnormal. This is blood outside of the spleen and outside the liver. And actually this slice, you can almost see a break in the splenic capsule. And this man has had a spontaneous rupture of his spleen. He had to have an emergency splenectomy but made a full recovery. And the motto of this story is that you should always be on the lookout for late complications and unusual things in cases of malaria. Vivax and Ovalle, just to whistle through, Ovalle has now been broken up further into Curtisi, Plasmodium Ovalle Curtisi and Wallacheri, but this is of sort of academic interest only. It's not associated with any clinical differences. And Ovalle is more common in West and Central Africa, where the lack of a Duffy antigen on the red cell prevents Vivax from getting a foothold. They tend to cause a benign disease, parasitemia tends to be lower, and they cause relapsing malaria. Those hypnozoites that were in brackets before come into play now. So some sporozoites that enter the liver, rather than resulting in merozoites in the circulation, they remain dormant, and they cause hypnozoites to develop. And these can remain dormant for some time, even up to a year in some strains of Vivax. And then for reasons that we're not quite sure of, they reactivate, become hepatic schizonts and cause the release of merozoites and cause clinical disease months down the line. This is to remind you that Vivax isn't always entirely benign. This was a 56-year-old cab driver who presented to the Hospital for Tropical Diseases with Vivax. After a few days, he became short of breath and, as you can see, developed ARDS and required hospitalization in the ICU. He was responding well, but then developed some transient neurological abnormalities with weakness in his arm, but rather more worryingly, irreversible loss of vision in one of his eyes. And fundoscopy and review by the ophthalmologist revealed that he had had ischemic anterior optic neuritis, which left him blind in that eye. He recovered from his ARDS and was able to go home, but his job as a cab driver was in jeopardy because of the loss of vision. So Vivax not always benign. Plasmodium malariae, uncommon and never causes severe disease, but it can persist for decades and is a rare cause of nephrotic syndrome, as all of the textbooks and examination books tell you. Lastly, Plasmodium knowlesi, Borneo and Southeast Asia, and it's a zoonosis. It's the rise in Plasmodium knowlesi can be accounted for by the movement of humans into the territory of macaques, largely in order to farm for palm oil. It has a short erythrocytic cycle, which means that quite high parasitemias can be reached, and as a result, it can cause quite severe disease. All of the benign malarias can be treated with chloroquine largely. If you have Vivax or Ovalle, you have to give another treatment to get rid of the hypnozoites, which is primaquine. Primaquine, just to remind you, can cause hemolysis in someone who has G6PD deficiency. For Plasmodium malariae and knowlesi, chloroquine alone will be enough. But in actual fact, all of the anti-malarials will be effective. And there have been some studies showing that dihydroartemisinin piperaquine causes a more rapid resolution of Vivax parasitemia. Another case, 32-year-old man who had been traveling around Togo in West Africa and then presented with fever, lethargy, dyspnea, and ankle swelling. He'd had an episode of malaria diagnosed in Togo 2 weeks before this, and at that time he'd had a hemoglobin test measured by a bedside HemoQ machine, and he'd been told that it was 130. Despite not having severe malaria, he'd been treated with intramuscular artemether, and that had been followed by a full course of dihydroartemisinin piperaquine, and he had responded to this treatment. Later, he became febrile again and became more short of breath and developed some ankle swelling. His hemoglobin was noted to have dropped to 11 grams per deciliter. And then over the next 3 days, his hemoglobin dropped further. He was started on some treatment with IV ofloxacin and oral doxycycline in case he had a doxycycline-responsive fever. And he was evacuated to the UK from Togo. When he was seen, he was febrile, tachycardic, jaundiced and pale with hepatosplenomegaly. He was quite profoundly anemic at this stage and also thrombocytopenic and had hemoglobinuria on a dipstick. He had a raised reticulocyte count and a full hemolysis screen showed typical findings for hemolysis. His rapid test for malaria was positive, but he had several malaria slides that were negative. And just to remind you, the HRP2 antigen remains positive for some time after you've been treated for malaria. So this could have been a case of treated malaria. He had a screen for hemoglobinopathy, and that was all normal. He had a direct Coombs test, which was negative, and he had normal hemotinics. And after multiple negative slides and some further investigations with a full infection screen, a bone marrow that showed that his marrow was producing red cells, as indicated by his reticulocytosis, he had no autoantibodies, he had no cold agglutinins or hot agglutinins, and even went on to have a PET scan looking for occult malignancy, which was negative, and by exclusion, a diagnosis of post-artemisinin delayed hemolysis was made. He had 4 transfusions over 6 days, many of them more than one unit, and then his hemolysis resolved. And this was written up by Joe Jarvis in The Lancet a few years back. So post-artemisinin delayed hemolysis is something that we're becoming more aware of. I'd be interested to hear if you have any experience of it yourselves. And it tends to occur up to a couple of weeks after parenteral artemisinin therapy. It's thought, although there's lots of unknowns here, that it relates to pitting of erythrocytes that have been infected with young ring stages. So artemisinins, in contrast to some of the other treatments, can kill the very young forms of malaria. And when red cells infected by these young forms pass through the spleen, rather than being entirely removed from the circulation, as happens with the older cells, which either lyse or are removed by the spleen, the spleen is able to pluck out the small ring stage, leaving a red cell that is weakened but still functioning. And that red cell then continues in the circulation but has a shorter lifespan. And it is thought that these red cells breaking apart 7, 10, 14 days later is what gives rise to this hemolysis. Although it's unclear why the disease then remains refractory to transfusion and can continue for many days afterwards, despite replacement of the abnormal cells with transfused ones. People have also looked at whether bone marrow suppression is involved, and in some cases there does seem to be bone marrow suppression, but in other cases there isn't. So the jury is really out on the causes of this. The implications have been looked at quite recently, and it's felt that the life-saving properties of artesunate outweigh the risks that are being described, and the UK guidance is that you should check the hemoglobin 2 weeks after artesunate therapy. I think the American guidance is a bit more careful, and they say every week for a month you should check the hemoglobin after intravenous artesunate therapy. The other development, if you like, in therapy is one that is rather depressing and rather like antibiotic resistance. We have artemisinin resistance. I'm just going to whiz through this. There were early signs of this in the beginning of this millennia with reductions in the 28-day treatment success. And then there was this study published in the New England Journal by Arian Dundorp and colleagues showing clearly that in pilin, there was a slower response to artemisinins than there was in Thailand. That's just to show you where pilin is. on the border between Thailand and Cambodia. The reassuring thing is that despite the delayed clearance, which is illustrated by this line showing declining parasite biomass over time, this is artemisinins when they're fully active. Despite the delay, it's still on a par with the nearest best treatment that we have other than artemisinins. Artemisinin resistance has been difficult to keep a handle on because it has required clinical studies demonstrating slow clearance. To some extent, those have been aided by quantitative PCR and more so by the possibility of genetic markers. And many of you may have read about this K13 propeller mutation, which is said to indicate artemisinin resistance. Happily, it still seems to be confined to Southeast Asia. In terms of its implications for severe malaria, we still think that you should be treating with artesunate. There's talk of doing studies looking at combination therapy with quinine, but I think at the moment that's still talk. For non-severe malaria, there's a bit more going on, and there are studies looking at whether a six-day course of an ACT rather than a three-day course of an ACT would be better. And there's talk about triple ACTs with perhaps mefloquine added to dihydroartemisinin piperaquine. And there may be new drugs on the horizon. Cipargamin, or KAE609, is under development by Novartis and has recently completed phase two studies in Thailand. It's been looked at in, so far, only about 20 cases of malaria in humans, but there it has a very rapid clearance of both falciparum and vivax infection, including some infections with resistant parasites. And as yet, no safety issues, but it is quite early in the days. And then another drug that I've not got direct involvement with, tofenaquine, which is under development by GSK. And this is a single-dose treatment for hypnozoites in vivax disease. And it will have similar problems to primaquine because people with G6P deficiency may still get hemolysis. And this is undergoing phase three trials. So I think that's all I've got to say about malaria. Happy to take questions.